Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. It's great to see you here. Thanks for coming out. This event is called How Can We Tackle Inequalities Through British Public Policy? Who knows what's happening tomorrow? Spring budget. So we're very timely, right? Okay, so we should be talking about that. This is an event that's organized by the International Inequalities Institute. Inequalities are us. And there are many ways of thinking about inequalities, whether vertical, horizontal, intergenerational, regional, and international. And we'll be hearing from our speakers about aspects of all those things. So welcome. I'm Stephen Jenkins. I'm part of the Social Policy Department. I'm very pleased to welcome here Neil Lee, Tanya Burkhart, and Mike Savage to you all. Neil is a professor of economic geography in the Department of Geography and Environment, whose research looks at cities, economic change, and the social dimensions of innovation. Tanya is the Associate Director of CASE, Centre for Analysis of Social Exclusion, and also part of the Social Policy Department here. Most of Tanya's work is about multidimensional inequality and disadvantage, in particular through the lens of a capability approach. Mike is the Martin White Professor of Sociology at LSE, the author of 8 books, many of them, including The Return of Inequality, quite recent. So what the speakers are going to do is discuss their work on inequalities and how their findings could impact British public policy, particularly with the election on the horizon. And as I said, maybe we can talk about tomorrow's budget. We shall see. For Twitter users, if you're one of those, though I suppose we shouldn't call it Twitter, we should call it something else. But anyway, the hashtag for today is #LSEIII. So the event is being recorded, and there will be a video recording hopefully afterwards, subject to everything working. There's also a BSL interpreter here, which will be good for the recording. So as usual, what we'll have is the speakers going first, and then after them, you have got the opportunity to put your questions to our speakers. So it really helpful if you can give us your name and affiliation when you ask the questions. And we're particularly pleased to hear from students and alums. So I'll let you know when the floor is open for questions. You just raise your hand and I'll find you and pick you, and I hope we'll have time. So I'm now delighted to hand over to Neil Lee. Thank you, Neil.
So first of all, thank you for coming tonight. Particularly thanks to those of you who already had 3 hours of me talking at you today. So, hugely appreciated.
Those who are doing my course. So what I'm going to do is 3 things, right? So we have this great question. How can we tackle inequalities through British public policy? And I'm going to be sort of answering this. I'm going to be doing 3 things. I'm going to first of all reflect on sort of what I've learned so far as someone who has worked in sort of both the crossover space of public policy and also academia. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about one specific area of policy, which is levelling up. And I'm an economic geographer. I'm going to talk about levelling up, and I'm going to talk about some of the problems in addressing inequality in that way, through the levelling up agenda. And then I'm going to finish up by talking a little bit about what next, because there's a sort of momentous day coming at some point soon in the UK. We should all be sort of positioning ourselves to think about how we can impact on either side of the political aisle. And I want to basically think through what exactly we could do next with that. But let me start off with a little bit of sort of background. So I've been an academic for almost exactly 10 years. Before that, I worked for a think tank. And when I moved to LSE, I remember having a conversation with a very senior politician or a very senior political advisor. And the senior political advisor, he said, look, one of the things about the LSE is it's got like the best place in the country at impact. And he talked about CASE, which Tanya works at. He talks about the sort of, the work which is done by people like actually Stephen, work of people like Mike, all of these people who do incredible sort of policy work at LSE. And in my time here at LSE, I've been to a Conservative Party conference, I've been to the Labour Party conference, I've spoken to senior politicians
on both sides in a sort of non-partisan way. So I thought I would start my presentation by just thinking through, like, what are the concrete, definitive, impactful moments I have where the things I can say I have definitely shaped policy in a positive way, which will address inequality. And I came up with this, and this isn't a slide which has gone wrong. Okay, this is like, actually, I wasn't sure what I had, which I could clearly define and claim as my own. And I'll talk about the reasons for that a bit later. But basically, you know, the sort of subtext here is a couple of things are going on, right? First of all, policy is complicated. So like, I'm married to a civil servant. You know, she's the first person to remind me how complicated life is once you step away from the ivory tower of somewhere like the LSE. It's a difficult place. And I'd like to sort of introduce, and I'll refer back to this, just the idea that sometimes we talk about policy, and by which I mean people like, you know, the classically Sir Humphrey in the sort of old TV series Yes Minister, or people like my wife, the people who are sort of doing techie work, sort of looking at how we can understand the world and how we can sort of improve it in a sort of policy way. The people who actually take a manifesto commitment and make it into action versus politics. And politics being the sort of type of stuff which is often done, you know, by politicians who sort of, you know, set the agenda and drive forward the world. And actually, I think often I've been very good at sort of influencing policy, but not nearly so good at influencing politics for a sort of, and I think this is a bad thing. And it's a bad thing partly because I think I've been sort of, you know, in all my work focused on inequality, I've been sort of going for a sort of, you know, what should be a sort of open goal, right? You know, it should be an open goal because most people believe that the income distribution is unfair. This is from the British Social Attitude Survey. Most people think that we should be spending more on health, education, and sort of social benefits. Actually, you can see the sort of, you know, crossover there was when I faced the decision early in my life of whether I came to the LSE or whether I worked in a sort of very senior level at work. I wasn't at a senior level of government, but worked for a very senior politician, and I chose to come to the LSE, which looked like a good decision now, but hasn't always done. But, you know, so we're sort of focused on this thing where basically I think most people agree that the income distribution in the UK is not great. Most people would agree that we need to do something about it. I think that's across both sides of the aisle. And so the question is, actually, having been in that situation, why are we not doing better? Why are we not doing better? And how can my work feed through to help us do a little better? So I'm going to give you an example of where I think the sort of problems of policy, politics sort of hit and why things are sometimes quite much harder to achieve than they should be. And this is somewhere where my research, you know, does a lot of, where I've done a lot of research. And the example here is levelling up. So this is our last Prime Minister, but two, I think, Boris Johnson. Come, is it two? Like, correct me if I'm wrong. And when he was on the steps of Downing Street in 2019, he said, we are going to unite and level up. We're going to sort of bring this country, we're going to address inequality. And for me, this is really interesting for a number of reasons. One reason it's interesting is because this is like a spatial goal. You know, I'm an economic geographer. I think geography really matters. And actually, you know, Boris Johnson was sort of saying that it matters as well. It's like a life-affirming moment for people like me. But it's also, in a way, kind of a sort of inequality-reducing message. And I think it's interesting that this sort of inequality-reducing message came from someone on the sort of right of the political spectrum as well. And fortunately, you know, I had something which I've done a lot of work on. And since then, actually, I've done lots of work for, you know, I've done work, academic work, but lots of sort of policy-focused work as well, both with sort of, you know, the older sort of conservative administrations, but also with Labour. Now, the problem with levelling up is that it's something of a wicked problem. It's a problem which is very hard to solve, where it is entrenched, or hard, maybe even impossible to solve, where policies, different policies are sort of interacting to sort of come up with an eventual outcome. So this is from my work with people like Mark Francham, Luis Bellus from the Centre for Economic Performance, and this is essentially inequality, spatial inequality in the UK. And it's just one measure of spatial inequality. And you see the UK line here is in red, the United States is orange, and then sort of, well, Germany and France, black and blue respectively. And the key thing which you guys are all thinking looking at this graph is actually inequality has been reducing anyway. So maybe in some sense people like me who've been doing policy-focused work on levelling up have been achieving something. But actually, you know, that would be the charitable interpretation. But the less charitable interpretation is actually what you see in this graph is that inequality was basically driven by the success of the economy in the 2000s. That was driving spatial inequality. Since then, the economy's been doing less well, and we've seen spatial inequality actually fall in by this measure. So for people like me who want to say that spatial inequality is incredibly, you know, it's got really bad, it's sort of very difficult, hard to target, actually, what this shows us is that spatial inequality, at least by this one measure, is falling, and as it's falling, that's having this sort of, you know, second order, you know, this is, that's having a sort of, you know, as it's falling, we're still talking about it more and more and more. So there's a sort of difference between the politics and the sort of policy here. But the other thing here, which is important, is that this is an unintended consequence of other things which are going on in the country. The fact the country hasn't been very well run in other ways has contributed to lower growth and it's reduced inequality. So I'd say it's a kind of bad reduction in inequality, if you can call it that. Now, what's been happening? Like, policy has been, you know, important. So this is a set of, you know, the different institutions and agendas which have been important over this period. You see, some of you with sort of older memories will remember sort of regional development agencies. Some with even older memories will remember development corporations. These are things which we don't even teach now these days. But what's happened essentially is that at the same time as sort of spatial inequality being reducing because the economy's not been doing very well, we've been going through this phase where basically, you know, a leveling up phase in the economy where there has been continual churn of policy. Policy has been churning, and essentially what's happened is that Boris Johnson has said, you know, he's looked at this as a political opportunity, he's looked at inequality not so much as something to be solved, but something to sort of talk about. And he's basically put in place a load of things, which each of which basically allow him to have a press release, to be sort of simple about it. So all of these things allow him to have press releases. Some of them are quite sensible, you know, some of the sort of devolution deals, the city deals. Others are just sort of showboating. The UK Shared Prosperity Fund, elements of that are sort of pretty difficult to justify. So what's been happening? So spatial policy involves policy trade-offs, and this interacts with the sort of political system in a way which means that actually, you know, even people like Boris Johnson, who most people in this room, I suspect, would not hugely approve of, at least was rhetorically focused on reducing inequality. But the problem is that our political system incentivized him not to do something which is going to solve these problems genuinely. It's incentivized him to do stuff which just re-announces potential sort of sticking plasters rather than anything more than that. So leveling up has become this sort of politicized version of sort of regional development rather than the sort of long-term process which we need. So what are my solutions to this? What are my solutions for spatial inequality in the UK? I have lots. Let me give you four, and then based on some sort of conversations I've had with senior politicians, I'll explain what the problems of them are. So these are one thing you could do. One problem we have in the UK is that there's, you know, funding going to local authorities is very piecemeal and it's very short term. You give them money for a couple of years and then it makes it hard for them to strategize, do things over the longer term, be strategic, all of that sort of stuff. So one simple solution you could do is give them longer term funding pots which allow them to move from place to place, you know, move the funding from, say, budget for youth centres to budget for adult social care. Another thing you could do is you could integrate the British Business Bank, the UK Infrastructure Bank, and local authorities. You know, we have these institutions, it'd be relatively quick, relatively easy to just do that. Seems there's sort of obvious policy solution there. You could build capacity. When we were part of Europe, we had a European Investment Bank which was helping weaker local authorities build up their capacity. Now we don't have anything of the sort, and at the same time we've hollowed out capacity at a local level. If you talk to the private sector, they'll say, actually one of the problems we have is not so much that there aren't sort of investable propositions, it's that we don't trust the local authorities to work with us to bring them to market. And another idea you might have is some sort of CHIPS and Hub Science Act type tech hub program, where you create new tech hubs in the regions by sort of investing sort of loads of money. So like a confident LSE academic, I've been to senior politicians and I've been very clearly told the problems with all of these policies. And the problems are basically not so much with the policy, the problems are with the politics. Long-term funding pots for LA local authorities, it's boring, it's geeky, you can't get it past the Treasury. Better integration between British Business Bank, UK Investment Bank and local authorities, it's boring, it's geeky, it's vague. I mean, these are things which are basically describing me. Capacity building for local authorities, boring. It's hard to take credit for. If you're Boris Johnson, why on earth would you build capacity at a local level? Like, local areas are just going to take credit for stuff, whereas actually you could be doing it yourself. My most successful, probably, was the new Chips and Science type tech hub program. I suggested this. I thought, like, they're doing it in the United States. We could do it here. We could build some, like, tech hubs in the sort of regions like, places like Manchester or sort of Sheffield. And, you know, this is great because it's exciting, right? Everyone wants to have some sort of new tech hubs. The problem, and it's partially obscured here, is that it's extremely expensive, like almost unfeasibly expensive, given where we are in this country. And actually, the problem as well is that it might actually increase inequality. You know, you just increase inequality between Sheffield and Doncaster rather than sort of increasing inequality between, at the same time as reducing inequality between London and Sheffield. So basically, all of my sort of policy messages, you know, these hard-worked policies, well thought out, based on solid academic evidence, all coming from the LSE, the problem is not the policy, it's the politics of them. So how should we do it? How should we sort of like, part of what you can do is just sort of hide that within a manifesto with some sort of eye-catching suggestions at the same time. What I would suggest is basically the way that policy seems to me to have worked in my like almost 20 years of working in policy is, first of all, you have to accept, if you're like me, you have to accept the marginal gains. We're not going to completely devolve. I had a sort of session with some, policymakers a couple of years ago, and I said, why don't you, like, devolve power to the city, set the cities free? And the first thing they said was, look, you know, we're not going to set the cities free. We're going to sort of, like, you know, maybe give them slightly more power. And at first I was sort of upset with this, but actually, you know, they were right. It's about marginal gains often in a sort of political system like we've got. Second sort of thing, which I think I wish I'd done earlier, is these build relationships. Build relationships with policymakers as they come into, you know, as they come into power, as politicians come into power, civil servants as they get sort of better, as they sort of stay in post. It's quite difficult to do in the UK system because many civil servants, they sort of churn through. I think other things you could do is I'm always struck by like Mike's work on sort of inequality is that he's just built awareness of this sort of issue in different ways over a long term. And I think this is actually the sort of thing which we need to be doing more of. And clearly we need to be sort of playing the long game. Like, you know, you can only win with marginal gains to address inequality if you play it over a long time period. I think often I've been personally very guilty of sort of moving on to the next fashionable thing in a very sort of Boris Johnson-esque way, actually. So what next? Let me just conclude with what I think we can actually do about inequality. So one thing which is clear is that policy moves in waves, right? You start off with, you know, stuff which feels entirely unlikely. You know, I'm old enough to remember sort of, you know, the Blair government it was, I think, sort of saying, you know, thinking about devolution to cities outside of London and not being keen on doing it at all. But then eventually enough people sort of fall into line, enough people make the case, and eventually you end up with a sort of, you know, a coalition of people, which means that it does feel like the right thing to do. And actually, I'd say this with like, you know, Levelling Up. One of the successes of Levelling Up was for a time, Michael Gove and Lisa Nandy, they had like an arms race of like, who could do the more in terms of sort of devolution, who could sort of try and get more powers out of their parties, essentially, or out of their power bases into the cities. You have to wait for opportunities. That's one thing. Now, I think, is a really, really important opportunity for what might happen in public policy. We have a general election. You know, when is the next one? No one really knows. Could be May, could be November, could be January, depending on how things are going. But the problem is, and I think, you know, this feels like quite a timely event, but actually, I think, you know, the time to do a lot of my things, which I certainly wish I'd been doing in public policy, you know, the time to do this stuff was a couple of years ago, because the manifestos are probably already written. Like, in terms of the civil servants are now, the budget is tomorrow, so, you know, nothing I say today is going to influence the budget unless it's really controversial or an amazing idea. And I don't have any amazing ideas. And so basically we're sort of, you know, in the stage now where we're sort of, you know, hoping that the stuff we've done in the past is going to be impactful enough to impact on public policy in the next phase. So thank you. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much. Now, Tanya Burkhart will carry things along.
Thanks very much. So, I'm going to pick up where Neil left off and talk about the welfare state, broadly defined, and some other policy levers that we might want to think about in terms of tackling inequalities through British public policy. And I should say that a lot of the ideas that I'm going to be offering to you are drawn from work of many colleagues in the Centre for Analysis of Social Exclusion and elsewhere, and I will try to remember to credit them as we go through. So I'm going to very briefly talk through three points. The first, that the high levels of inequality that we experience here in the UK are not inevitable. Sometimes, particularly those of us who've been around a while, can begin to feel pretty pessimistic, if not downright cynical, about the possibility of change. Then I want to home in on the role of social security and the way in which it's a very powerful lever in relation to particularly income inequality, both for better and for worse. And finally, show you the poverty and inequality policy toolkit, which was developed in case a few years ago. So first of all, in terms of the way in which inequality is not inevitable. This is a graph from the IFS Deaton Review of Inequalities, showing Gini coefficient, very widely used measure of income inequality across OECD countries in 2019. The yellow orange bar highlighted there is the UK, towards the right hand side, higher inequality. As you can see, there are many, many countries, even just within the OECD, that are to the left of us, lower inequality. And some of those are the usual suspects, the Scandinavian countries that I think you would probably expect to see there on the left-hand side of the graph. But there are several that are perfectly plausible comparator countries for the UK. Germany, France, Austria, for example, all have lower levels of income inequality than we do. So it doesn't have to be like this. There's nothing inherent about the way that our economy works, or the state of Britain, or our demographic composition, or any of those things that make it inevitable that we put up with the levels of high levels of inequality that we have. And indeed, it hasn't always been like that. We don't have to look very far back. This chart starts in the 1960s, goes up to just pre-pandemic, to see that inequality levels were lower before the big rise in the 1980s. So this chart's showing a range of different inequality and relative poverty measures, with the various ratio measures shown on the left-hand axis and the solid lines, and the right-hand axis for the Gini coefficients and the relative poverty measure with the dashed lines. Broadly speaking, there are interesting differences between them that people like our chair, Stephen, has analysed. But broadly speaking, they all show the same pattern, much lower levels of inequality, bumping around in the 1960s, 1970s, big rise in the 1980s, flattening out in the 1990s and through into the 2000s. So not only is it not the case that inequality is at a high level everywhere across the OECD, not as high as in the UK, it's also not the case that the UK has always had the same high levels of inequality as we do now. We've just reached a new equilibrium, and we could move in a different direction. Taking the very long view, Neil was talking about needing to play the long game, and I'm going to play a really long game because I'm going back to the 1950s, for example. And if we take a really long view, we can celebrate the way in which a number of different broader indicators of inequality, not just income inequality, have really been transformed over that period. Now, I'm not going to claim that all of this is a result of specific policy interventions. It's a combination of economic change, social and demographic change, and specific policies and investments. So we can take higher education, for example, a subject dear to many of our hearts. In 1950, 3% of a cohort would go into higher education. It was the preserve of a very small elite. In 2019, just before the pandemic, nearly half of a cohort would participate in higher education. That's not just a reduction in elitism, it's also a reflection of the huge expansion and increases in levels of attainment at school level education, including through widening participation right up to and including A levels. We've seen huge increases in life expectancy, again, taking this long view, again, of 12 years on average between 1950 and 2019. Now, I know some of you will be aware that those gains have not been evenly shared. So a man living in some of the most deprived, in one of the most deprived areas of England, for example, will can expect to live 9 years less than a man living in the most in the least deprived areas of England, and the gap for women is about 8 years. So there are still inequalities there, but in terms of the overall narrowing of the gap, there has been significant progress, reversing in the most in the very most recent period since 2019. In terms of housing, nearly one in five households lacked an indoor WC, an indoor toilet, in the mid-1960s, a statistic that surprises many people, I think. That figure came down to such a small number of houses that they actually stopped counting it in the 1990s. And instead, we've shifted to a decent home standard, including measures, for example, of damp in houses. Damp in houses is a very serious problem. We've seen some horrendous consequences of damp in houses, but it actually only affects 3% of homes in 2019. So again, massive progress in terms of equalising the housing conditions that people enjoy. Pensioner poverty, another massive success story, down to a combination of both fiscal welfare and occupational welfare, and changes over this period, halved between 1961 and 2019. So across a number of measures, taking the long view, it is possible, it has been achieved, to make substantial social progress, including narrowing inequality. But unfortunately, as you will be aware, there are some notable omissions and oversights and some policy areas which can at best be described as having been inconsistent over this long view as well. I think if I was to go on Mastermind, social care would probably have to be my specialist subject, a subject very dear to my heart, but I will restrict myself to a single bullet point on social care this evening. Peter Townsend very famously produced a book called The Last Refuge in 1962, which was an excoriating investigation and expose of conditions in long-term care, residential care for the elderly. He recommended shutting down what used to be previously workhouses that were being used to accommodate elderly people, moving people into the community in order to improve the conditions in which elderly people were looked after. But unfortunately, if you look at the Care Quality Commission reviews of residential homes in 2019, half a century and more later, we find that one in six were rated as inadequate or requiring improvement. We have around one in three of the care workforce on 0 hours contracts, a turnover of one in three annually in those care staff, and so on and so forth. So we don't seem to have made very much progress in terms of the quality of our care for the elderly. Child poverty has yo-yoed around between one in eight and one in four children being in poverty over this period, with both successes and failures. No consistent efficacy in reducing child poverty. I want to home in on that a little bit more now to look at specifically at the role of Social Security. So this is a chart from a publication I can't recommend highly enough, produced by the Child Poverty Action Group, and which my colleague Kitty Stewart is one of the authors, launched just a couple of weeks ago, about ending child poverty. And this chart shows the two versions of the poverty line, the relative poverty line after housing costs and the relative poverty line before housing costs, for children from the mid-1990s through to the latest figures that we have. And we can see that the period in which child poverty was broadly falling commenced, perhaps not entirely coincidentally, in around 1997, when the then Blair government made a pledge to halve child poverty and indeed to abolish it within a generation. You can also see on this same chart the effect of that £20 uplift on universal credit that was a specific COVID measure. You'll remember that that was then reversed, so that the £20 uplift was taken back off universal credit. And you can see that that had an immediate impact, both in terms of reducing a sharp fall in child poverty at the time the £20 uplift was given, and an increase, a tick up in child poverty when it was once again removed. So there's a lot here about the way in which Social Security can be a positive influence. In fact, over the period of the Labour government, the Blair and Brown Labour administrations, about £18 billion more was spent per year at the end of that government on children and families benefits than was the case in 1997. And that was no small contribution to reducing child poverty over that period. Drilling down in a little bit more detail and looking particularly at the most recent period, this chart takes a different split from the same report, the same CPAC report, this time looking at the family size. So the two lines close together are only children and children who have just one sibling. The dark line at the top is children with two or more siblings. Again, it's poverty rate after housing costs. And we can see a big kick up in the poverty rate amongst those larger families, children in larger families, from the period of 2013, which was when the benefit cap was introduced, a limit regardless of the needs or size of the family on the total amount of benefit income that the family could receive. And again, the two-child limit, so-called, introduced in 2017. So Social Security is a really powerful tool in relation to inequality and poverty, for better or worse. So the challenge for us tonight really was to think about what could be done, how can British public policy tackle inequalities. And the last thing I wanted to share with you was this poverty and inequality policy toolkit that was developed in collaboration with the Joseph Rowntree Foundation by Irene Buccelli, Abigail McKnight and Kate Summers a few years ago, and they're actually just updating the toolkit again now. And the idea was to try and identify those policies that would have a double dividend, or stood a chance of having a double dividend, in terms of both narrowing gaps and also boosting the bottom, however defined according to different policy areas. And they identified seven broad areas of policy where there could be these double dividends, those shown on the slide there. This is a website that you can visit. Here it is. You, indeed, we hope also policymakers, people working in think tanks, whoever else is trying to shape policy. Here are those seven areas. If we just click through, for example, into housing, we can see a little bit of a description about the ways in which housing policy can help to narrow inequalities, or could also, of course, in some cases, widen inequalities. And it's talking both about the raising the standards of housing at the bottom and making housing more affordable, as well as thinking about housing as an asset and its contribution towards embedding and entrenching advantage through the holdings of wealth and the ability to generate an income stream, for example, through buy-to-let, being a private landlord. So scrolling down, we can see a sort of classification of the types of policy approach that you might want to think about in relation to housing. That's probably a bit small for you to read some of the text there. But here we've got unequal ownership, properties generating income flows and asset accumulation, policies that might tackle that, policies that might tackle lack of affordable housing, and policies in relation to housing costs that are exacerbating existing inequalities and poverty. One of those is the idea of regulating the private rental market as a way to mitigate those inequalities. we scroll down and look in a little bit more detail at the idea of that particular proposal, we can see we've got details of what that kind of, what the rationale for that type of policy intervention might be. We've got a summary of the degree of political support for, in this case, rent controls. The Labour government, in its previous election manifesto, committed to a whole suite of rent control type measures. We've yet to see how many of those survive into the forthcoming manifesto. The Scottish Government, this is a devolved area of policy, the Scottish Government has already gone further than the Westminster Government in terms of ensuring that tenants in the private sector have longer tenancies, for example, boosting the negotiating power of the tenants vis-a-vis the landlords. You can see a summary also of the degree of public support that these policies enjoy, and a quick review also of the academic evidence on how effective this type of approach might be in terms of reducing inequality and poverty. And the evidence here is certainly mixed, so it's not a straightforward case, in particular because of the possible effect on supply, reducing supply through rent controls. But the balance of evidence is very much in favour of this as one element of a broader housing policy alongside social housing policy, for example. So I just wanted to share that with you and encourage you, if you're interested or if you think there are other people who you know who may be interested, to have a browse, have a look at that toolkit. The one thing I think that it really does remind us is that there is no excuse for doing nothing. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Tanya. Now it's the turn of Mike Savage. Thanks, Mike.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Stephen and everyone. It's very unusual for me to be talking about public policy because I'm a sociologist. Sociologists are famously better at diagnosing what's wrong with the world than fixing the world, but I will have a go, and I'm going to focus particularly on this issue of how do we tackle wealth inequality. By wealth inequality, we mean inequality tied up in people's assets of various kinds. So it can be property, stocks and shares, savings, financial instruments. And this, I want to try and... I do want to make actually a sociological point, and I'm going to draw on the work of my colleagues in this theme which I convene around wealth, elites and tax justice, to say we need to do two things. I'm going to give you some examples of what we have tried to do. One of them is develop specific policy proposals, or what we might call policy widgets, you know, concrete plans, costed plans, which you can see how they would be implemented by government. And I'm going to talk about that particularly with respect to my colleague's work around developing proposals for a wealth tax. But you also need to reframe the debate, because policy only takes shape within parameters which define areas which need to be tackled. And if we are going to tackle wealth inequality, we need to shift a debate about what is a serious problem today. My colleague at the III, Sarah Kerr, has this very interesting book about to appear in a few months' time called Wealth, Poverty and Enduring Inequality. Let's Talk Wealthity. Which is a very interesting example of how you reframe the debate. So, you know, much of the policy thinking is around how do we tackle poverty? How do we lift people into a better economic position? I mean, much of Tanya's discussion was about that. Really, really important. It's really important to define ways of improving people's lives. But you can also argue that wealth is a problem. Extreme wealth is a problem for a number of reasons. One of them is that those people may be monopolising money, which could be used for people in the bottom, and those people could also be buying influence, buying governmental lobbying power, using those resources to help their kids do well in education, or buying houses, or getting internships, all these things. So actually, we need to think about defining wealth as a problem to be tackled. That's an issue of reframing the debate. And we try to work on both of these lines, developing proposals, but also thinking about reframing it and understanding why wealth matters. And I want to show you a couple of graphs. Now, I'm not an economist, but in this book I published recently, The Return of Inequality, I reflect on some of the key findings from economists. And I'm struck by this figure here. It's a very simple figure, which is looking at the average wealth per head in the UK over the last 100 years or so. And it shows this really remarkable upward line. In about 1985, I think it was, the average person in the UK had £100,000 of wealth. That's mashing together everything you might count, property, pension assets, etc. It took several millennia to get that £100,000 back, okay? You can go back centuries and centuries. And as you can see, in the first part of the century, it actually declined. Began to build after the Second World War. And then in 2005, I think it was, it had doubled that. That's an astonishing transformation. In just 30 odd years, the average amount of wealth to double. Now you might think, on the face of it, isn't that good? So much more wealth around. We must be living in a much more prosperous society. But of course, when you think about distribution of wealth, it's a very different understanding, because the bottom half of the distribution, the bottom half of the population, have virtually no wealth. So they're in the same position as they were 300 years ago in terms of wealth. The top 1% take about 20% of the wealth. So this huge increase in aggregate average wealth is massively benefiting people at the top and has pulled us apart in a much more intense way than we've ever experienced in history. Scary. So that's why wealthity, as well as poverty, might be seen as something we need to tackle. Second graph, which I think is very, I'm very attracted to, is by, again, these economists, Piketty and Zuckerman, who coined this phrase, capital is back. And they're partly riffing off Karl Marx, you know, and our emphasis about we need to understand capital. Capital is a force which accumulates. And this is what they've done here, is they've put the total amount of wealth as a ratio of the size of national income to look at the kind of the balance, if you like, between the total amount of stocks of wealth in society and versus or compared to the levels of income. What this shows is that that capital income ratio declined during the 20th century, which is a good thing, because it means income is more important. It means people are working and that their employment is generating income. People are not living off so much off rents and unearned income. So it's, you might say it's much more attuned to a meritocratic society. But over the last 50 years, that ratio has been increasing again. Now, one of the reasons I find this graph powerful is that if you go back to the period before the First World War, when the capital income ratio was also high, that was a period when we had a government, a liberal government it was, which actually made the claim that because wealth was produced by the community, it was only fair that the community should get something back. And that was the government which developed proposals around taxing unearned income at a higher rate than earned income. It developed death duties and it seriously thought about tackling wealth. And I think we're not at that stage yet, if we're honest. Even though capital is back, we have not yet got to that awareness. Our capital gains tax rate is still below the income tax rate, not how it was 100 years ago. So that's the reframing issue, how we need to think about changing the terms of the debate. But we also need to think about particular policy proposals. And here I'm just pointing and calling out some of the colleagues we have working in this theme around wealth, who have really taken the broad insight that we need to understand wealth and treat it as an issue, a problem, if you like. And they've tried to make it much more concrete as to how we do that. And I particularly want to call out this proposal for a wealth tax for the UK. So Aaron Nadvani, Emma Chamberlain and Andy Summers, in an amazingly short period of time during COVID in 2020, about 9 months, they developed this wealth tax commission, which put together some proposals for a wealth tax. So we don't currently have a wealth tax in the UK. Tax is not, but wealth is not directly taxed. What you try to do here is reflect upon, well, what threshold could you set it at? How much would you need? How much should wealthy people pay? How much would it bring in? How do you avoid, how do you administer it? How do you deal with problems like wealthy people might leave? So very practical issues. I like to think, we've heard about Boris Johnson already, I like to think, you know, he had this thing about the oven-ready policy, you know, the oven-ready trade deal, which was supposed to be, then, get us out of the problem of Brexit. I like to think about the wealth tax idea as, this has made the wealth tax oven-ready. So rather than an abstract view about we should tax wealthy people, we now know how you might do that and what the financial benefits may be, and they are considerable. So their proposal was, their costly proposal, was that tax wealth over £1 million threshold. This is a really high threshold. Most people would not be paying wealth tax at all. But if you set that at 5%, a one-off wealth tax, 5% over £1 million would generate something like £150 billion to the Exchequer. That would be transformative for British public finances. So what you get in that is a concrete proposal, which therefore becomes much more realistic. But I now want to make it even more concrete by talking about some work which I've been slightly involved with Aaron Advani, David Berger, and Andy Summers around non-dom taxpayers. And so we've had the oven-ready policy. This is the policy which is actually in the oven, and it may even come out tomorrow. Look at the budget. But one of the things I've heard is this non-dom clause may be abolished tomorrow. If that happens, that is an amazing achievement of these colleagues who have really developed a costed and detailed understanding of what the non-dom clause does. They've done that by having teams of researchers in this secure data environment in the taxation authorities who've actually looked at people who fill in their tax returns and claim this non-dom status. It's an incredible piece of original research, which also leads to costed proposals. And I just want to spend a few minutes talking it through, because I also want to try and show it's not just about developing proposals, it's also about reframing our understanding of what the non-dom thing means. And what does the non-dom thing? We all know that Rishi Sunak's wife was outed a couple of years ago as being a non-dom. There's a big fuss about that. But what does it actually mean? If you live in the UK, and that means if you're living in the UK for 6 months or more, you have to file tax returns here. But if you claim on your tax return that your permanent home is another country, then you get certain exemptions on your tax. You don't have to pay tax on your overseas assets, and you avoid certain aspects of inheritance tax. So you basically get tax benefits from claiming your permanent home is somewhere else. It has a long history. It goes back to when UK first charged income tax, because it allowed elites, basically, who had interests outside the UK not to have to pay tax on their overseas assets. So we're thinking about plantation owners in the Caribbean, we're thinking about aristocratic interests across the empire. And it really draws upon the concept of domicile itself, which was crystallised in British law during the 19th century. This is a very unusual concept. Most countries don't have it. I think the UK is unique in having it. What it entails is it allows individuals to say, my home isn't just where I was born. I can choose to define my home as a different country. This is, in a way, it's a kind of British white settler mentality. You can go to Australia or other part of the world and say, this is my home. And then that means you'll say, I am domiciled in a different country. So it's a really interesting imperial, you know. We have this big discussion about decolonising. This is actually very much an imperialistic clause, which has nonetheless remained in British taxation policy. And it is used to allow people living in Britain now to claim some exemptions. So this is the policy widget, which Andy and Emma and Aaron developed. What they did is they basically went into the taxation secure data environment. They looked at people who claimed to be non-DOMs and looked at people who were very similar to those non-DOMs on other criteria, like their age and their industry they worked in and their residence, and they just compared the income streams between them to see what might be expected to be raised if the non-DOM clause was abolished. And what they found out is that, well, I've extracted their highlights here. 10 billion in offshore income and gains, which are not taxed currently. And the key figure is the one in bold, which is that if their estimate was that if you abolished the non-DOM regime, it would raise £3.2 billion. That means this is income, this is wealth, if you like, up offshore by UK residents, and which is not taxed. It would be taxed if the non-DOM clause was abolished. Significant amount of money. And I think what's important there is dealing with a concrete number makes the discussion about non-DOMs, you know, something you can understand. It makes it not just an ethereal, oh, we don't like the non-DOMs. It's making it much more concrete, and then you can think about, should it be abolished? They also look at longitudinal data. They look at the non-DOMs over time to see how many of them might leave. Big discussion about one of the reasons why people often say you can't tax wealth is it's said, well, people will leave. If you tax wealth, they'll go off to wherever, a different country with lower tax rates. Various of us are doing various projects on this. We are doubtful about that. And they were able to show, too, that the tightening up of non-DOM rules in previous years has not really led to any major difference in non-DOM leaving the country. So, overall, it's a really powerful and persuasive argument about the tax avoidance, if you like, which the non-DOM clause allows, and how that can be fixed. And I say, this could change tomorrow. It certainly is currently Labour Party policy to abolish this clause if they are elected. But I also want to say a little bit about the framing part of it, just by showing some of the work which they produced in Data Lab. This is the Taxation Secure Environment. This is the first ever analysis of how many people are non-DOMs, how well off they are, and which part of the world are they linked to. So this is really fundamentally original research. Not many people are non-DOMs. Less than 100,000 people a year claim to be non-DOMs, but when you look at, you link up records over time, quite a few people have claimed to be non-DOM at some point or other between 2001 and 2017, 250,000 nearly. So quite a lot of people at some point claim to be non-domiciled. This is really the kind of staggering figure, because what they have done here, what we have done here, is we have looked at people, these are all extremely high earners in the UK labour market. On the right hand side, people earning £10 million or more. This is the 0.01%. Once you get to that level, a third are claiming to be non-DOMs. So this is really concentrated at the top. It's a device used by people who are extremely well off, presumably also to preserve their overseas assets, which are not being taxed. So you can see that the trade-off between high incomes and high wealth is being preserved here. So the vast majority of people are not non-DOMs, but once you get to this very small portion at the top, you see how that this clause is being used. I'm really interested in this question of empire. Is the British Empire ended? Not really. This is a map of where non-DOMs, where their permanent home might be. We're using linked data about their citizenship and other characteristics. Many, and the dark blue areas are the areas where the highest portion of non-DOMs claim an affiliation. You can see most of them, many of them, are former parts of the British Empire. Australia, India, USA, Canada, South Africa. And indeed, if you group all nations into a series of types, which we've done in this chart here, around 60% of non-DOMs are, you know, their affiliation is to kind of a certain part of the British Empire. We're very interested in the ex-Dominion countries, Australia, Canada, South Africa, Ireland. New Zealand, kind of white settler colonies, these high proportion of non-doms. So the influence is actually, the big thing is that a lot of these people claiming to be non-doms are white. So they're not, you know, they are white people claiming to have non-dom status, which is giving them economic advantages. But also, and to show you, I love this graph, because you can do this very macro analysis of different nations, but you can also mine it into different parts of London. Nearly all non-doms live in London. It's the only part of the country they live in. And you can imagine the effect they have on the London housing market, and the way in which their wealth and high incomes are driving up property prices and affecting all of us. And you can see absolutely the extent to which they are focused in the wealthiest parts of London. So one of the correlations which David Berger did was the correlation between the average house price in the local area and the proportion of non-doms, and the correlation was 0.9, which is almost impossibly high. So we can see how issues around housing markets are also linked into this non-dom phenomenon. So I hope what I'm trying to suggest is, you know, we need to think about policy in two ways. One of them is develop concrete policy widgets, and Aaron and Andy in particular have done that. But it's not just a matter of doing that. You can only do that once you've actually defined problems to be tackled, and you've thought about what are the issues we need to address. And that involves having to rethink outside the box. I use this phrase, turning the telescope, so looking up to the wealthy and thinking, well, how do we bring them into the policy frame and think about getting them to take some responsibility for their advantages? Michael Vaughan, who's in the back here, is a media researcher. He's doing some fantastically interesting work around how wealthy people are visualised, how they're framed in the media, and what kind of ways do the public have for understanding the issues around wealth. So I hope this has been of interest to you. If you are interested, we are having a half-day symposium on May the 13th on why wealth inequality matters. Reporting new findings covering wealth distribution, racial wealth divide, gender wealth divides, how wealth affects social mobility. So please make it in your diary and do come along to that. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Great, thanks very much for the presentation. So now we'll move to open the floor for questions. A couple of rules of the game is that because we're being recorded, if you're going to ask a question, you must use the microphone. Semi-compulsory is please give your name and affiliation. And it would be also useful to indicate if your question is directed at one particular person or to the whole panel. Clearly, there's been a huge range of issues covered here, both in terms of policies and politics. So there's lots to talk about. And it'll be also interesting to know whether or not you're optimists or pessimists in this area. So, ladies and gentlemen, the gentleman over here is kicking us off. Thank you. The microphone's just coming.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ ask social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thank you, gentlemen, members of the public. Our first speaker, I can't remember your name, sorry. You mentioned most inequalities with moving money from London to the northern cities. I think the problem is more between the cities and the rural areas. I just saw an article in the paper about the mining communities after 40 years after the miners' strike are still pretty poor. They've moved bins and prettified the place. There's no jobs there now, so that's my question. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Neil, wouldn't you take that?
Yeah.
Others can prepare your hands.
So, I mean,
So it's a fair point, right? So what we have in the UK is a couple of things which are unusual. So one thing which is unusual in the UK is that our big cities are not as productive as they would be, the equivalent sort of big sort of medium-sized cities would be in other countries. So cities like Birmingham, Sheffield, Manchester, they don't do quite as well as they would do. There is definitely a large swathe of sort of particularly sort of Midlands, north of the UK, parts of sort of Cornwall, for example, as well, which are also sort of rural areas which are relatively poor. But in the UK, we have this, if you look on aggregate, we have a sort of slightly different balance, because actually a lot of the countryside is relatively well off compared to sort of some of the other places. Now, actually, this is where it gets sort of interesting, is that, you know, if we want a sort of feasible strategy for which will sort of reduce inequality between, say, the south and the north, which is, you know, commonly the north-south divide, one sort of feasible strategy would be that you basically go, right, we're going to invest in the UK's sort of, you know, big cities to try and get them up to the levels of productivity and wages of similar cities elsewhere. There are two problems with that, right? One problem is political, because we have a sort of constituency-based system, which makes it very hard to sort of focus investment in particular areas. The second problem is that which is also an issue, is that you end up with so the first problem is political. The second problem is that actually can increase inequality by some measures, because you're simply choosing other parts of the country sort of which will be richer, and you'll end up with a sort of inequality which increases by other measures as well.
Thanks very much. Any others?
Oh, yes, sir, please. Thank you.
As a geographer, some comments on, or questions, I think, for Professor Lee, and indeed the others. We've heard such a variety of problems, such a variety of solutions, well worthy of Sir Humphrey, of course, sorry. I wonder whether or not the basic problem is really the state of the economy. And you know, comparing Britain with France and Germany, with one of the graphs we saw how better they were on the inequality on the equality measure. But if we were to think about 10 years' time, surely the effort has to go in developing the economy. Now that might well involve some special hubs of growth, but that ought to be the priority in my view.
Thanks. Neil's had a go. Somebody else want to?
Come to you after. So thanks. And that's obviously a very familiar argument, that actually it's got to be economic growth first, and then we see where we get to. And there's quite a lot of work that suggests that economic growth does not reduce inequality by itself. So it depends what you do with the economic growth. You can adopt a suite of policies that give the proceeds of economic growth to those that already have. They get more. Same is true, I believe, geographically, that you can have economic growth that also widens spatial inequalities. Or you can adopt a suite of policies that ensure that those gains from economic growth are redistributed more fairly, some would say, or at least more evenly, in a way that would then narrow inequalities. So I don't think that economic growth is a solution by itself. It needs to be in combination with a set of policies that specifically tackle inequality. There's also an interesting area, I think, to consider whether inequality itself at the kinds of very high levels that we now have in the UK are themselves an impediment to economic growth. That actually, flipping around your observation, one might need to think about particular forms of inequality narrowing policy that are needed now in order to generate economic growth. And I'm thinking there, for example, about ways in which the underinvestment in the health service mean that we have a very high level of worklessness, people out of work due to long-term sickness and disability, who are then not able to contribute to growing the economy through employment. So there are ways in which we might want to choose a social investment strategy now to reduce inequality in order to promote economic growth.
Great, thanks very much. Mike, do you want to?
Well, just quickly, I mean, there's this very famous book, I'm not sure if you know it, The Spirit Level, which came out about 15 years ago, and it's been criticised, but I mean, the basic argument it makes, which is to say, if you rank countries on the basis of their economic prosperity, that is not a good measure of their well-being in general. And the classic case is the US. It's the richest country in the world, the most dynamic economy in the world. Is it, in terms of life chances, in terms of well-being, is it the best country in the world? No, it's right down there. So I think, economic growth in itself is not going to be enough to address these big social issues.
Okay. Yeah, no, the twist on that argument might be along the lines about where the policy focus should be. We've heard quite a lot from Mike, for example, about having a go at the top, but also Tanya talking about the bottom. We're talking about inequalities, and there are different ways of doing it. Politicians, as you know, are often more attracted to reducing disadvantage or poverty rather than inequalities themselves. So it'd be interesting if you've got views about those sorts of things amongst the others. Yes, ma'am. Here in the middle. No, wait for the mic, please.
Hi, my name is Erin Sofianic. I'm from the Local Economic Development, MSC. Thank you all for the very interesting talk. That was great. This is a question for Professor Lee as well, but anyone who wants to answer it. So you mentioned the role of devolution and kind of redistributing powers to local authorities. And I'm curious as to what you see as some practical ways to make sure that the reallocation of fiscal and policy-related responsibilities doesn't inadvertently increase inequality because of differing initial starting capacities.
So it's a great question. I think you're spot on, actually. The problem is if you devolve powers with no other sort of nothing accompanying that, then of course you'd end up with areas which do better than others, and those would tend to be the richer areas, I suspect. So I would normally frame it as a sort of growth first type policy, but with a couple of caveats. So the first caveat is you have to do this sort of capacity building at a local level stuff at the same time. So you can't just leave local areas to sort of, you can't just devolve to local areas until you've built up their capacity to sort of deal with that. So that's the first thing I'd say. And then the second thing is in the UK, we already have we have inequality of devolution already, right? So we have this messy patchwork quilt of devolution where some areas have trailblazers. London has got well-established devolution for quite some time. And actually, we've seen that devolution's helped London with stuff I came in this morning on Crossrail, and one of the things about Crossrail is that it was part funded by local business charges. And that's been great. So my argument would be that actually the problem at the moment is that we need a bit of that, along with those sort of policy measures to sort of help equalize, make sure places are given a chance to use those powers. And then also that would help address the inequality we have at the moment in the UK.
Great, thanks for that.
Come in on that as well. So I mean, I think it's also worth asking inequality between what or between who you're concerned about. So one thing is about inequality between an area that gets devolution and those that don't get devolution. And clearly there is the potential for devolution to increase that form of inequality. But I think there are some very interesting effects within an area that is devolved to. I'm thinking here, for example, of Greater Manchester that's had considerably more devolution than many other areas in the UK or in England. And there, Greater Manchester is made up of a very varied set of individual local authorities, some quite wealthy, some very deprived. And the kind of collaboration that's possible through coming together in the form of Greater Manchester with devolved powers, budgets, resources, etc., has enabled considerable benefits for the more deprived local authorities within that bigger Greater Manchester combined authority. So there you see an inequality narrowing effect of devolution from the centre to a collection of local authorities. Don't know if you'd agree, Neil.
Yeah, I think that's, I'm not going to disagree.
I'm going to let you, you've lived in Manchester, right? Uh-huh. So experienced it.
Yeah, look, I prefer to Neil on the local devolution issue. I do think, I mean, as I brought out in my talk, I mean, London the issue about London is a really important one, isn't it? London is such a, you know, it's driving the British economy. It's so far ahead of the other parts of the country, and it's tied into all these global networks and global flows. And that's one of the reasons why it is so wealthy. And how it's kind of how you would allow local devolution to Manchester or Birmingham or wherever. But what do we do about London? And I think that's, so again, it's, do you look at the top as well as lifting things at the bottom, I guess.
Yeah, another thing we could talk about perhaps is, it's come up in all the themes, is how we get the right messages from the ivory tower, if you will, to the movers and shakers, whoever they are, and perhaps vice versa, to get academics doing the right sort of thing. So, you know, the two-way flow. So I'd be interested in your views from either outside as students or as others, what you think about those sorts of things. Tell us what we should be doing better, where your approach is. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. I'm a Brazil honorary fellow, University of Roehampton School of Education. So I'm particularly interested, obviously, in schools, maintained schools. And I'll direct the question to Professor Lee in the first instance. On your slide, you were talking at one point about some suggestions. Your first suggestion was long-term funding pots for local authorities. My interest is in understanding structurally how the hard nub of the most disadvantaged pupils in English schools can be helped and supported in a way that it appears now with the fragmentation of the school system where education has been removed since Michael Gove's time under the coalition government from local authorities. It's no longer LEAs, as you know, it's LAs. Structurally, how an equitable distribution of support for these areas disadvantaged these pupils when the locally democratic structure is no longer in place and has been replaced by the marketization of school places through, I'm going to cite Sharon Gurwitz and Stephen Ball, their work around how models like free schools and the academization program that was kind of subverted from its first iteration to being middle class parents can game the system, and we've got concentrations, we've got a stratification of schools where the most disadvantaged pupils are located increasingly, and that kind of even hand of the local authority is gone. So I wonder, my question is, how can we achieve, number one, long-term funding pots? The cupboard is bare for things like special education needs, gypsy women, traveler, refugee and asylum seekers, children with English as additional language. That's gone out of local authorities' control, and you have this completely fragmented, maintained school system. So I'm just wondering that how can these things happen, leveling up geographically or even within one area, one structurally, the delivery structure's gone.
Yeah, okay. There's quite a lot in that question, and also with the caveat that I don't know that much about education policy, but I can, you know, from what I do know, I think, let me make a couple of quick observations. So I think, you know, I talked about funding pots, and I think I described it as geeky and boring, and I think it is, and I think I also tried to make this distinction between sort of policy and politics. And one thing which I think has been really interesting in this country is, like, you know, as someone who has kids at different stages of the school system, is how noticeable the change has been over the last 10 years. And I think it's really interesting that there has been a noticeable change in the way in which the, you know, if I phrase this correctly, so there's been the academic standards actually still seem to be relatively high, but the sort of stuff around it seems to have gone, you know, degenerated quite a lot. And actually, I would say, you know, I suspect that I don't notice that so much because I'm, you know, pretty privileged, but, and I hope my kids don't notice it, but I suspect you would really notice it if you were from a sort of difficult background. You know, all this stuff you're talking about the sort of challenges for, you know, for challenging children from sort of difficult backgrounds. You know, in the kids' school my kids are at, there's a lot of refugee kids who need to sort of, you know, get their English language up to scratch. There's very little support and stuff like that. So I'd say, you know, so I guess my first point is like, you know, my first response is, yeah, it's not so much, it's partly about the sort of funding pots, but it's also about the size of those pots. And it's been amazing how those have managed, seem to have been cut in a way which sort of hasn't been penalized at the ballot box yet. So that'd be my sort of, you know, response. And then the second thing I'd say is like, I think a lot of this stuff is, you know, I think I'd be interested in your view and people on the panel's view, whether this is done better in places like Scotland or Wales or Northern Ireland, given that school is also actually partially, schooling is devolved, I think, as a sort of matter. So that'd be my sort of question for these guys as well.
Yeah, the other thing I'd encourage them to reply on is the thing you were picking up about short-term versus long-term and the nature of how structures can maybe hinder or impede any particular process. So the floor is yours, however you wish to pick up on those things.
Yeah, so thanks for the question. Very, very interesting set of observations, and agree with everything that Neil's said too. Also having children at various points in the school system and noticing the same sorts of phenomenon. Another parallel trend, it seems to me, is the recreation of structures that look almost like local education authorities. Through, for example, multi-academy trusts. So we've increasingly seen that individual schools have found it's very hard to actually manage alone because there are some particular needs, there are some particular resources, facilities, training opportunities, I mean, you name it. Lo and behold, it turns out it's actually easier to do that if you're part of some sort of collective. So both formally and informally, I think we've seen the reinvention of structures that have been eviscerated or abolished in the, you know, preceding 10 years. So I think that pendulum is already swinging back towards more coordination, more, if not local authority level, then at least kind of above school level coordination of some of these needs. Whether that will in turn address some of the inequalities that you're talking about, particularly, again, you know, spatial inequalities within local authorities, I'm a bit less confident, particularly as we've seen that the selective admission system, the de facto selective admission systems of these, some of these academies, and definitely free schools, tend to exacerbate those inequalities.
I'm not an expert on education, but the one thing I can throw into this, which follows Tanya, is my brother is a governor of a primary school in Lincolnshire, and it's experiences all these issues about fragmentation, and his sense about the local authority, the LEA, which used to have a devolutionary awareness of issues beyond particular schools and could develop plans, it has lost its power and authority. And in that context, you've got trusts, but they may have different motives and different incentives. So there's a real issue, isn't there, about how to plan coherently when you're losing the local power of the LEA, I think.
Yeah. Another issue I put to you, I know this is billed as an event to learn about things we should do with British policy, but I ask you all, certainly looking around the room, are there lessons from other countries that should be applied to the UK? I think from what we've heard, it sounds like Britain needs some help. So any ideas, ladies and gentlemen? Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, so I'm French. My name is Corinne, and I just come here from France. I have a feeling, although I live in UK since 40 years, so I'm not living in France, but I have a place in France, and I can see the French seem to do much more reforms at the level of taxation. And I don't see it in UK, since I'm in UK. For example, you know, on owning a house and the allowance that you can have, whatever the size of the house is, if you're living as one person in a big house, you pay less, although you're in a huge house and occupying, obviously, a big space which could be occupied by several other people and benefiting, yes, from tax reliefs. Mm-hmm. That for me, sounds like totally incoherent. That's one thing that I see. Now, devolution, we don't speak about that in France. I was used to, I have a place in Brittany, and that was extremely poor 40 years ago, and the French government has given money to Brittany. Now it's becoming an not independent, but it's part of France, and it's very prosperous, although they manage their own arrangement of the, you know, the area, the region. These are the things that I've noticed.
Yeah, thanks. As time is moving on, I'm going to collect that question, and there are two more. One here, the woman here with the grey cardigan, and the gentleman behind it. So we'll have those, and then that'll probably take us to the end. Thanks,
Ray. All right. Hi, I'm Yun. I'm a civil servant, even though I don't look like a civil servant. So I work for DSIT, Department of Science and Technology Innovation. My question is about, because it's tax-related. I think I want to talk about something like daily inequalities about council tax. Because council tax, we value, we have the council tax band. And then that is the kind of valued and it started from 1991, which the house values are quite different to now.
I can't quite, can you, at least?
Yeah. House values.
So about council tax. So what I'm talking about, like daily inequality. So the London house value is way more expensive than when it was valued in 1991. So the current council tax band is wrong. So, you know, so I don't know how to, because I wasn't working, but I was supporting council tax team, and then they don't know how to tackle these inequalities. And then we want to ask, you know, you guys are like a research, and then is there any way we can tackle this? Spending less money, because we can't do house value again from the beginning. That was my kind of practical question.
Great. To you. Thanks very much. And the gentleman behind you, thanks, in the blue hoodie. Thank
Hello,
you.
I'm Zhang. I'm a student here at LSE studying political sociology. So I have this question for Professor Mike Savage. Can a focus on private wealth be useful for identifying class division? And can it improve the current NSAC occupational oriented class classification?
Great, thanks very much for this question. So we'll have our final round across the panelists answering these three interesting questions. Thanks very much. Do you want to go first, Mike?
I'll start that last question. Thank you. It's nice to have a sociological question. yes, so that's the question you pose is, we conventionally think about class divisions in terms of occupations, and that's the way we do it using the NSSEC, the National Statistics Socioeconomic Classification. And there's this other argument that actually the kind of wealth inequality which I was talking about would be an alternative way of thinking about class. For instance, because these days, you know, a lot of your privileges and advantages come from, say, owning a big house, you know, regardless of what job you do. So, and I absolutely think that's the way, that is the direction of travel and a lot of thinking about class, about trying either to replace the occupational model with one which is focused around trying to understand wealth. And the originators of class theory, Marx and Weber, that's how they thought about class. It was to do with your relationship to the means of production and capital, really. It wasn't to do with occupation. So I'm very sympathetic. Currently, we don't really have a operational way of doing that, so that would need to do a lot of work. The question about, yes, council tax, look, absolutely. We do not tax property very much, really, and this goes back to the point about how income tax carries such a lot of weight of fundraising, and forms of taxation on property and capital are less so, and I don't see any reason why you couldn't revalue properties. There is a distinctive thing in London because of the value of the properties. It means you can charge quite low council tax, and we saw Grenfell Tower, which a council which was determined to keep the charges there amongst the lowest in the country. So that is absolutely a place which I think needs to be looked at. Thank you.
I think this is a really clear example. The council tax revaluation, I think, is a really clear example of Neil's point about the difference between politics and policy. So I don't think you'd find anybody within the relevant departments, government departments, who wouldn't agree with the case that there should be a revaluation and that current council tax is an irrational tax. But if you were to revalue, you would have some winners and some losers. And even if you calibrated it so that there were more winners than there were losers, the losers would be noisier and more politically damaging. And that's why it hasn't been possible for any party so far to advance that as a part of their policy commitments.
Yeah, Neil, last word, perhaps commenting also on Franco-UK comparison.
So French point's really interesting. The UK has a similar sort of average household income to France, but with a much higher sort of dispersion, basically. So this goes to Tanya's point that we basically tolerate inequality relative to another similar country, which looks like they might do that rather better than we do. I think we can sort of learn from that. And I was going to make the same point on council tax, that I think this is a political problem, but I have a suggestion to solve it, which is that Mike has almost solved non-DOMs. So once his group have done that, they can do wealth tax and then move on to council tax evaluation. And then we'll have achieved something tonight.
Okay. So I asked you whether or not you're a pessimist or optimist, and we're taking out on the optimist wave. So I'd like to thank you all very much for coming along. It's been a great opportunity for me and for everybody, I hope, to hear these speakers. So thank you very much to them, very grateful to them. Glad that you could make it, and thanks very much to the ESL interpreter. So thank you very much and good evening.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.